you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 66 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, Barrister.
Myself, Mark Tottenham, Barrister and Editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And we're in a slightly different environment today. We are here in these beautiful podcast studios on the banks of the River Dodder in Dartry. That's a bit of a mouthful.
That's right.
It's a gorgeous part of the world, isn't it?
There's a sort of funny kind of undulating place
looking
with
at that
some...
golf course, Milltown Golf Course. It looks fabulous.
Right, yeah,
looks fabulous.
What are those people doing?
I think it's the 14th green, but I could be wrong in that. But it looks really, really good. So we're delighted to be here today, sort of home from home, and thank you to Dee Reddy for looking after us so well here on the premises. Clio is the leading provider of cloud-based legal practice management software, providing lawyers with an easy-to-set-up, affordable solution to manage and grow your firm more effectively, more profitably, and with better client experiences. Start a free trial today. Visit clio.com/IE. Mark, as you will recall, we had a fantastic discussion last week with Saoirse Brady, who is the Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust. And we talked to her about alternatives to prison and incarceration and whether locking people up is the best thing to do and is that in society's interest?
Yeah.
Really good discussion.
Definitely, yeah. And the issue of people who have, you know, psychiatric issues who maybe aren't being as well looked after in the prison system as they should be.
Yeah, no, it was really good. And I loved the bit. I loved the bit about the fact that a survey of employers said they were willing to give people who come out of prison a chance, give them a job.
Yeah,
get them back into society. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I thought that was really, really good. Well, today we are delighted to welcome to studio retired District Court Judge Olan Kelleher. And he's going to talk to us about his fascinating career on the bench in Cork in the District Court for 14 years. Olan is a legend, I think, on Lee's side. I think that's fair to say. And I'm really looking forward to getting his insights into the world of the District Court.
That's right. And I think there's also something we should mention. Am I right in thinking that you're giving a very prestigious lecture in the near future?
Mark, you're very kind. You're very kind. Yes, well, thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, I think it's this Thursday, actually. It's getting very close. I better make sure my notes are in order. I'm talking at the Latouche Regulatory Conference, which is running for 2 days, Thursday and Friday.
Regulatory law, that's my thing. Our listeners' pulse is racing.
Well, it's got to be good. I'm talking about protected disclosures, which is a very interesting topic.
I always remind people, protected disclosures are what we call whistleblowers. Isn't that
whistleblowing
right?
Law.
So basically, this is where somebody finds that their employer is doing something wrong and they cry stop. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Hey, come here. How many Hollywood movies have we seen where the hero is the whistleblower?
Exactly.
And the great news is that an amendment came in last year. Remember, this law goes back to 2014.
Sure.
And the amendment gives greater protections to whistleblowers. And I'm going to be telling people all
about that. So if anybody wants to know about that, they go to the regulatory law.
You can listen to me. And we also have some great case law. And a friend of the court, Gerard Hogan, gave a very interesting decision in the Supreme Court. So loads of that. So thank you for mentioning that. Anyway, we shall return to the podcast. And can we start with three cases that you've identified from the Decisus website? And our first case today concerns the thorny topic of waste management. I'm kind of getting all Tony Soprano now hearing about this waste management, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
A high court decision concerned a case stated from the district court following the refusal of a waste management permit to an individual in question because the individual had a conviction. Tony Soprano.
So yeah, the issue here seems to be the wording of a phrase, whether you are a fit and proper person to be awarded a waste management permit. And in this particular case, the plaintiff had a previous conviction under the Act, and what the district court judge really wanted to establish was, is that alone going to be sufficient to prevent them being a fit and proper person to get a license under the Act? And it was referred to by the district court to the High Court, and Mr. Justice Conleth Bradley made a decision and said that under the terms of the Act, that did preclude them from getting the waste management permit.
Okay, very good. Very well explained. And I should say that that's the case of Alan Pilkington trading as Pilkington Grab Hire, not Cab Hire, Grab Hire, versus Offaly County Council. So thank you for that. Okay, next to a planning case, which concerns your old friend Delay, Mark. Wow, another Delay case. But this time there's a twist. Even though there was a lot of time involved, Delay wasn't the operative factor in this case, I believe. This involved an application for the return of security of €68,000. And it goes back way back to 2009.
Yes, so sometimes in a planning application, when a condition is laid down in relation to certain matters, effectively money has to be lodged by the developer or by the applicant with the local authority, and that gets paid back once they've complied with certain aspects of the planning permission. In this case, as you said, 68,000 was paid by the developer, and the developer said, or its company, the developer said that they had complied with the condition. The local authority said they hadn't, and the claim was issued in 2009. So here we are, 15 years later, and the case had not reached its conclusion. And so the application was brought by the local authority to strike it out on the grounds of delay. And Mr. Justice Connells, yes, Bradley, who said, no, there has to be a causal connection between the delay and any prejudice that is claimed by the local authority. And he said they couldn't really point to any prejudice. And just the fact that there'd been such a long delay before the hearing of the case didn't mean it should be struck out. And that is the case of Dwyer Nolan Developments and the County Council of Wicklow.
Yes, that seems like a very significant decision. I think so, yeah. People who have a lot of delay in their lives might look at this with interest and see if they can come within the ramifications of that decision. So again, Mr. Justice Conrad Bradley. Finally, to a curious case of misconduct in the courtroom involving a serving prisoner. This is the case of Murray versus the Governor of the Midlands Prison. And it's a Court of Appeal decision given by Miss Unani Rafferty. In this case, the Court of Appeal upheld a High Court decision that a prisoner serving a sentence can be disciplined under the prison rules for misconduct occurring in a courtroom during sentencing. I presume when he's still incarcerated, is that it? And still prisoner.
Basically, they adjourned the case for sentencing and he was remanded in custody. When he came back into the courtroom, he threw a Bible at the sentencing judge. And needless to say, he was removed from the courtroom and the remainder of the hearing took place by way of video link. But it was the prison authorities that sought to penalise him for his conduct in the courtroom. And he then, I think by way of judicial review, sought to challenge this and said, well, no, this was misconduct in the courtroom. This wasn't misconduct in prison. And the High Court said that, in fact, because he was in custody, he was under the control of the prison governor, even when he was in court, it was appropriate for him to be punished by the prison governor. And that was upheld by the Court of Appeal.
OK, very interesting. Three great cases there, Mark. Thank you very much for those. And back shortly with retired District Court Judge Olan Kelleher.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
So it is my great pleasure to welcome to the studio retired District Court Judge Olan Kelleher. Olan, it's only been a couple of months. Are you getting used to being called retired District Court Judge? Because it's only since last October, I believe.
Yeah, it's a big change, all right, from jumping out of bed in the morning facing 200 people in court. But I'm getting used to not to having to do that. But I do miss it, I must admit.
Yeah, no, you loved it and we're going to talk about it. But I believe you've been accepting an accolade or two in the meantime. Did I hear something about Cork Person of the Millennium or something like that, was it?
Yeah, I got it for January only now, but we won't be doing anything in compared to Roy Keane now or Killian Murphy. So it's just for the month. And at the end of the year, they do an overall one then.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so look, let's go back to where it all began. I think you have a strong background in law in Cork.
Yeah, my eldest brother, there's 20 years between his Humphrey. I was apprenticed to him and he was a district court judge in Kerry for 27 years, I think. And he did a great job there over the years and was very well respected.
Yeah, no, hugely respected. And yourself, you were a solicitor in Cork City.
Yeah, a solicitor in Cork City, qualified in 1977 and worked as an assistant in Rowan Village Armour for 5 years. And then on the 2nd of June, 82, two of us set up a practice called Conway Keller at the time, and it's now called Cumann Keller Tobin. And I left there to be when I was appointed in 2010.
Okay. And that was kind of a sort of a commercial firm, sort of personal injuries, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, mainly personal injuries. And my partner was a very talented, brilliant man, no longer with us, Rory Conway, who was a specialist in the fishery area, and he represented all the fishermen in Europe on numerous occasions and was very well thought of. And we set it up, actually, just two of us and one girl. So something went right afterwards, mainly since I left, I think. But there are now 90 there, and there's 38 solicitors there.
90 there? Wow. 38 solicitors?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. And just your own background. So you grew up in Cork City?
Yeah, I was born on the Western Road in 1953, and which is between the college, really, and the Mardyk. It was a great area for sport. I was heavily involved in sport. We had some great sporting heroes when we were kids, like Noel Cantrell, captain United to win the Cup in 63. He was a few doors down. Tommy Kiernan, Jim Kiernan, played cricket and rugby for Ireland. And Barry McGann, who was probably the best of them, was a great player as well. So we had great role models in sport, and I spent my life playing sport.
Oh, really. They are Cork legends, absolutely. And you're a bit of a Cork legend yourself. You played a lot of rugby, didn't you?
I played club rugby. I played for Munster a few times when people were injured. I played, but I was a bit lucky then that I was sub when we beat the All Blacks. So we had about 15 reunions.
So you were in Thomond Park, alone at stands. You were there?
Yeah, yeah.
And you were a sub on that team?
I was, indeed, yeah.
Okay, and what was your position?
Scrum half.
Scrum half, okay.
But I always got a bit of a slagging. Moss Keane told a great story about me one time. I told Moss in confidence almost that you know, I would have loved to have played against the All Blacks. 5 minutes would have done me against the All Blacks. And Moss replied, it would have done the All Blacks too.
Well, of course, that was the legend until Soldiers Field. That was the only time an Irish team had ever beaten. And we know the play and how wonderful to be part of that.
Yes.
What, 14,000 people in Thomond Park?
Yeah.
Or was there 20, 30, 40,000 to everybody that claims they were there?
12, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a great coach, Tom Kieran, was a legend in Irish rugby as well, you know, and he was ahead of his time. In those days, you could only meet 48 hours before a match. And the match was on the October weekend on a Tuesday. But Tommy said that Saturday didn't come because it was a bank holiday. And we met on Saturday, in fact, and we trained, which was unheard of. So we were a bit ahead of our time in that. But that was all done.
So the extra day might have done it.
Might have done it, yeah.
Who was scrum half on that? I know Tony
Hall was captain.
Donal Caniff. Okay, yeah. And Tony Ward, of course, was out half. So that would have been, yeah.
At the height of his career, he was
fantastic. Yeah, of course, absolutely. And your club in Cork?
I played with Dolphin.
Dolphin,
at college, like originally.
Yeah. With them, you know. And which also produced the legendary Terry Kingston.
That's right.
Who went on to captain Munster Ireland against and beat Australia in about 1993, I think.
That's right.
In Musgrave Park this time.
It was, yeah. They had a great win there. Mick Galway got sent off. I was a selector that day, actually.
Were you? Okay.
But Terry Kingston was a great player and a great clubman.
Okay. So obviously the rugby pedigree is second to none. Olin, but you're also associated with association football as well in Cork, weren't you?
Well, I didn't play much. I played a small bit of senior league soccer, all right, but behind our door in the Mardyk, if you remember, they used to play the rugby used to be on a Saturday in the Mardyk, and the soccer, Cork Hibs and Cork Athletic were there, and we used to have big crowds going up. So it was inevitable you got caught up in it, and I never stopped going. Like, I went all over as free legal aid with the Cork City football team over Europe, and it was Borussia Mönchengladbach and Bayern Munich and all those places.
Wow. You know. And did you see George Best play?
I did.
Now, we are supposed to be talking about law, and we will talk about law at some stage. But did you ever see George Best?
He played once in Turner's Cross
for
Celtic in 1973, I think it was.
£1,000 a week, wasn't that?
He was kept up in the hotel, and it was kind of tough, really. Like, he was thrown into the dressing room, and the fellas said hello to him, went out and got £1,000 and went home, you know. And he was a show pony at that stage.
Yeah, but you got to see the great George Best career. Wouldn't we give anything to see him, you know, these days? Absolutely. But in terms of football, were you involved with the League of Ireland? Did you act for League of Ireland clubs? Or
I acted for Cork City for years. For years. And I had to do a lot of the appeals, you know, with the FAI in Dublin, you know. I'm on the committee, actually, in the FAI for appeals, but it's the appeal from the appeal as such, and it's never set, actually. But I've done that for the last 3 years.
Okay. So, come here, you had a thriving business as a solicitor. It's going very well. Look at the strength in terms of numbers, etc. Yeah. So the call came to be a district court judge. And, you know, so you obviously said yes. So what was the appeal of being a district court judge?
In practice, you know, you get bored after a while. I got bored, I'll be honest with you know, and I wasn't working as hard as I should have been. And I needed a new trick, really, to do. And I applied for this and I got it, and I loved it, and I never kind of looked back, and it's the happiest part of my legal career, actually.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. And but like, you know, you were an eminent solicitor, and listen, the district court is wonderful. But was it the High Court, Circuit Court, District Court? Was District Court the one you wanted?
It was, yeah. I'm not an academic, and I wouldn't have got the other ones anyway if I applied for them. So I only applied for the district court. I'd be better with the kind of crowds, I had a certain empathy through my family background, and my mother had been sick a lot when I was a child, and she suffered, it used to be called suffer from your nerves in those days, you know, but she was very ill and she was in hospital and stuff. So I had a natural empathy towards people who couldn't cope, you know.
Okay.
I think that, and I was always grateful to her for that, you know.
No, can I just ask you, before you get on to your career on the bench, you said you were getting bored with the work. Was there a particular type of work you found repetitious? Did you find it frustrating? Was there something about being a solicitor after a couple of decades that really made you feel, right, you know, I'm not making a difference here?
Yeah, a bit of that. But I think mainly what it was, I was doing personal injury mainly, and, you know, anyone could do it really after a while, you know.
And were you doing mainly personal injuries defence or plaintiff work?
Doing plaintiffs, and then I did defence, and then you do a bit of both, you know.
Sure.
But I just got a bit bored in general, I'd say, you know, and I needed a change, you know, and I started reading the books about change, you know. And then I did this, and I got the call, and I was delighted to get it.
And so then when you went onto the bench, obviously, I mean, you don't get to choose what kind of cases you sit on.
No.
Had you had in the course of your solicitor's career much experience of, say, criminal work or some of the other stuff that might have come before you?
Yeah, I should really admit this, but I hadn't a clue. I had to start, and you start with a page in front of you, and you have 200 people, and the best solicitors in Ireland were there in front of me, some of them great solicitors, and you just have to be careful and, you know, get the job done. But I had no experience of criminal law of any sort. I don't think you have to have it, actually. I think you pick it up quickly. It's experience of life is almost more important.
Sure. And I think a lot of people say the real justice happens in the district court, because so many more people have experience of, their experience of the court is coming before the district court, summary cases, decisions made very fast that might have quite severe consequences for you. I mean, you've good days, you've bad days. How does it feel when you first go out onto the bench? You've got this, as you say, 200 people in front of you and the first case comes up.
It's quite intimidating, I have no doubt about that, but you have to show that you're not intimidated, actually, is one of the things. I used to carry out, everyone is different now, but I used to carry this thing in my bag saying, it's a court of summary jurisdiction, you must keep remembering that, you know, that it's about numbers, really, in one sense. But the numbers, the effect, the decision you make on one of the numbers could have catastrophic effects for them, so you have to be careful. But I used to carry this around me, and I just put it up on the desk in front of me that they couldn't see. I said, be quick, be courteous, and no speeches.
Right.
And I think to get you home, I did it at the end as well, really. Right. I follow that mantra all the way, you know.
Quick, courteous, no speeches.
No speeches. Judges are terrible.
Could you tell
speeches.
A few of your colleagues about that?
I know.
Could you pass that information
I get
on?
Embarrassed by it, though, I do. But it is a terrible thing, you know. And what's really frustrating for the practitioners in front of you is that they're hearing all this theory and speeches from the judge, and they want to get on with the work, you know. Mm.
And one of the things, obviously, you say no speeches. One of the things you often hear people saying is that people want their day in court.
Yeah.
Do you feel that you have for want of a better term, a therapeutic role? There are people who need to be listened to, but you've got a whole list of cases behind them. To what extent do you have to give people the time to...
You have to give a certain amount of time. You see very sad faces in front of you, you know, and some of them are very ill, actually, you know, and they mightn't be getting much help. So you have to guide them to the probation services sometimes, who are very good. But the one thing that did shock me about it, I've been involved with sport all my life, and plenty of occasions when you go out and have a few jars, I couldn't believe the amount of alcohol the effect was. Everyone was telling me about drugs, but alcohol was much worse.
Right. In terms of...
For the presentation.
Particularly in criminal cases or in all types
criminal,
of cases?
Criminal, yeah.
Because, I mean, I imagine it affects personal injuries and family work and all that. And
family law as
you'd
well,
be dealing with all of that.
Yeah.
And alcohol is one of the biggest...
It is the biggest, I'd say, you know.
And is that still the case? I mean, from the time
things have changed now, but, you know, cannabis, I had a kind of benign enough view on the cannabis, but cocaine is rife now, you know. I mean... I've had a lot of experience with cocaine with people, and I try to divert them into the health side if they'd no previous convictions. But what I used to try and do then was to give them what's called Section 111 of the Probation Act. Without getting technical, it means that it is not a conviction, but it'll be recorded if they come before the court again.
Yeah.
Guess what? Some of my colleagues were doing was striking it oak, you know, pay 200 quid and be struck out, you know.
Yeah.
There must be some focus on it, I think, you know.
Of course, yeah. And so going back to how you start, is there, you have sort of some days that are criminal days, some days that are personal injuries days, some days that are family law days, and you've got your list of cases before them. Were there days that you dreaded more than others?
I dreaded drink driving, actually.
Right.
I used to call, there was a kind of a, over the last few years, it's changed a bit now, but when I started first, the lawyers used to come down from Dublin, and we used to call them the fat cat lawyers, like, you know, about, and they had all these points that we had never heard of, you know, when we started. And you had to be very careful and keep your mouth shut, you know, and make a decision on it. And the law in relation to drunk driving needs to be kind of overhauled in one sense. It has been going that way now, but with so many technical points. I don't blame the lawyers at all. They're doing their job. But there were some very technical decisions, not based in fact or reality. You know?
And so the fear is that somebody comes up with a particular interpretation of a particular section,
you haven't heard
and you've got to rule on it.
Yeah.
And presumably then that then goes into the press or whatever.
Yeah, well, you'd inevitably, if you were caught like that, say you'd like to think about it, you know.
Sure.
And you'd ring somebody else.
Yeah, well, like, we all need to ring people at times, I think, to get a bit of information. Just one quote I saw here from Frank Buttermer, who's a friend of the show, who's a previous guest of this show. He said at your retirement due in the court in Cork, he said, on behalf of the people I have represented, and we know he represents, I suppose, a criminal fraternity, for want of a better phrase, your empathy with those people is unequalled. And the respect you show them, that means an awful lot where people have to trust the criminal justice system. And just talking to you, Olin, empathy seems to be a huge part of everything you do.
Yeah, it is really. I just brought up that way. You know, you are who you're brought up by and all that, you know. I remember my mother telling me one time, and she was very well for years afterwards, now, but when she said to me, you know, she said I was very sick there a few months ago, and I was saying, yeah, and she said, she pointed to her chin and she said, always remember, you can be sick from here up as well as here down.
Okay.
But I've never forgotten it.
Yes.
So,
and you saw a lot of that.
I saw a lot of that. I mean, I saw it at home and I saw it then in court.
Yes.
All the time. So you have to be respectful of that, you know.
Okay. But you also have to be someone who hands down fines, someone who has to send people to prison.
Yeah.
You know, when the circumstances demand it. How did you find that?
I didn't mind that really. I used to try and work on the view that if they were violent, you know, if somebody kind of breaks into somebody's home, I don't care what the excuses are and how unlucky he was in life, and he frightens the life out of the woman inside in the house, I think he has to go to jail. And I think he has to learn that. Now, maybe if it was his first offence, you might look at it some way. But after that, people must be kind of safe in their houses. Like, I think that's the duty and the judge. I think you're the judge for the people of Cork and you must do that, you know.
Okay.
And of course, the other side of things, when you're dealing with a family law case, you have to make quite serious decisions as to who a child might live with.
Yes.
What provision is made. I mean, you're making really life-changing decisions for certain families. Was there any type of decision like that that would you ever find yourself lying awake at night going?
Yeah, I have been awake at night, but not much now, I have to admit, but not much more in private practice. but I have been now. The family law is very difficult, you see. Mm-hmm. And what people observing the family law mightn't realise is that people go to great ends not to tell the truth about what's really happening, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to get into the middle of it, you know.
And that's both in terms of the family finances and the overall setup.
Yeah, and the more serious things, really, like where I remember one lady, I didn't really believe her, and she had got a protection order, which is reasonably easy to get, and it should be, you know. But
that's then, just to, for any listeners who don't know, that's to protect you against somebody who's you've made an allegation of violent behaviour against.
The breach of that then, Marcus, it can be 12 months in jail. So it's a very serious offence. Like, it's very serious. You want to be sure, the judge should be sure what's happening, you know. And I had this woman in twice, and she was looking on two separate occasions to get a breach of the protection order, and I didn't believe her and I didn't grant it. And she came back a third time, and the solicitor very cleverly got a camera around her on his neck, and the time that she said the alleged event took place, he wasn't there at all.
I see.
And he had it on the camera.
So that was pretty clear evidence.
Yeah, it's not always like that, but you have to be careful, that's all I'm saying.
But, I mean, you have to be very discerning, I would have thought, as a district court judge. you hear a lot of yarns, don't you? Olin, you hear a lot of yarns, and you have to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, I would have thought. Do you do that? Do you instinctively know that, or do you...
Well, you'd have a good idea, but you must keep your mouth shut for a while, so that while you're deciding about whether he's telling the truth or not. But people would regularly come into the court to come up to the witness box, look, I'm here now, I better tell the truth. You know, and a fellow was up one day with me for not getting the summon, you know, the notice for a road traffic offence, you know. And I said, well, you have to come up to the witness box to swear that you didn't get it. And he got up to the top into the witness box and he looked up to me and he said, I can't do it, he said. And he walked on.
That was it. Okay. So he had to, yeah.
He's
so
doubly ill there, really.
So the court, so the court had the impact. And do you think people respect the court? Do you? I mean, you hear all these things about kind of people going in and maybe they don't anymore and we don't have the same values
for... I think you have an element of control, or it seems to be fair. But a fellow stopped me in the street actually last week and said to me, I want to thank you for sending me to jail. And I said, what was that? And I didn't recognise him, I'll be honest, you know. He said, it was a turning point. He said, and I'm married now with two kids and I'm going grand. Thanks very much. So that was lovely to hear that.
He turned it around, which is wonderful to hear. That's absolutely wonderful to hear. So actually talking about that, recidivism. Did you see the same faces? How many years were you on the bench?
Just short of 14.
14. Years, over those years, did you see people kind of popping up on a regular enough basis?
Yeah. You would all the time. But as I said earlier to Mark, drink was a huge problem. Fellas fall again, you know. The drink.
But, so falling into court?
Well, not into court, no, but they've committed a crime, like again.
Yes, falling drink, back into crime. Sorry, excuse me. Yeah, sorry.
One of the worst crimes we used to have, actually, and I try to be very tough on it because I thought it was awful, was that the Mercy Hospital is our hospital in the centre of the city, you know, and they have an accident emergency. So when the people get upset about something and they're drinking, they go in and they attack the nurses. Like, I mean, you wouldn't believe it. Like, sure. I know one nurse there, I won't give her name now, but in her late 30s, who'll never work again. You know, she gets such a beating like from these fellas. And it got well known then that I wouldn't put up with that. But the solicitors get cute then, you know. They tell you that, I know you have a very serious thing, but this is different, you know, about people who are... But can you imagine being in the A&E trying to look after people who are sick, worried about their children and et cetera, et cetera? In fact, we were there, my wife, I just drove in now with one of our grandchildren there one time while they were away. And they have cages in there now, you know. You're put into a room that's caged from the public.
So it's there's huge social problems out there. Olin, you did develop an initiative for kind of people with drug addicts, etc., didn't you? There was a kind of a program that you had where people were assigned to this to see if you could give them a second chance, I suppose.
Yeah, well, what it was really, it was kind of by accident. I nearly fell into it in the sense that cocaine has become a huge problem, and it was about 4 years ago, it started 5 years ago. And I found out through the rugby teams, actually, that fellas I knew were coaching, that the fellas, I'd see them after a game, they weren't taking a drink at all after the game. And I was saying, do they not go and have a few jars anymore?
It's the body beautiful, isn't it?
It is the body beautiful. I didn't know that, actually. That was okay. The first time I came across it. And it's a regular thing now that the boys come down.
I think it's across the country, yes.
Yeah, I know it's not Cork, you know. But so they were paying 200 quid for cocaine, and there was a few incidents then near pubs, like, where it was definitely fueled by cocaine. And I said, we have to do something about this. Like, so I just got on with the probation services. So what I did then, I upped the prices as such. Like, I made them pay 750 euro, if they had no convictions. Now, this was only if they had no convictions, 750 euro to the Cork City Drug Task Force. They'd have to go to them then, they'd have to see them about three times, and they'd have to produce, after 8 weeks, a letter saying they'd attended everything, and they have to pay the 750. Now, the reason I put it up so high was that I wanted them, the parents would have to know, I felt, if you charge enough, like, the parents would have to get involved and it might save somebody from it. You know? And it's been a great success, and there's nobody's to come back so far.
Okay, so it has worked. It has worked really well. Yeah. Okay.
But I have to say this now, cocaine is different. A different clientele have cocaine rather than those who have heroin, you know.
Yes, okay. And I mean, for people out there who, you know, mightn't understand the distinction between the various different courts, I mean, the district court obviously is the court of kind of general jurisdiction, yes, and it covers everything. Yeah. But it is an opening shop, I suppose. That's what phrase for sort of higher profile crimes as well. So you'd often have had people charged with very serious offences coming before you initially.
Yeah. Well, ironically, everything bar few things of offences against the state have to come to the district court first.
Yes.
You know, so like they all have to. The murders come to the district court. All rapes, they would, you know, and they'd be filtered on then. Like, I couldn't deal with that. We can only give 12 months and, on a consecutive sentence for 24 months, 2 years.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay. And I get the impression, just from talking to you here today, that of all the areas of law, it was crime was the one that really kind of, that you found the most interesting.
Yeah, I did really. I people ask me, how did you think of the crime? But I did unusual things when next door to our house on the Western Road was a very fancy guest house. And the High Court judges used to stay there when they were down. And there'd be two guards standing outside our door all the time during the High Court, minding the High Court judges. And one of them, he went on to play for Ireland, actually, in rugby. Mick Leahy was his name, was very nice to me outside. And he encouraged me to go down to the court when I was 10 or 11. And I started going down to the courthouse at 10 or 11 to see the cases, you know. And I'd recommend anyone do it. And I said it, I was talking to one of my girls, a lawyer as well, and I was saying to her, he said, sure, you brought us to the John Gilligan trial in Dublin. I'd forgotten that now, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
20 years ago.
Just to see it.
Yeah, and I think that's important. You know? And I'm not saying, it's just, I found it interesting what made them tick, like, really.
Yeah, yeah. And just in terms of judicial discretion, I mean, obviously there's law out there and, you know, yeah, we as legal practitioners, we're supposed to know the law. We're supposed, yes, to be able to advise people because we know the law. But, I mean, there's a huge amount of discretion as a judge, and that's the way it should be.
Yes, I'd agree with that, yeah. But I think you have to get certain chances, and it must be clear in your court, like, that I'm giving you the Probation Act on this occasion because you're going to turn your life around, you to say, and all that, appreciate all that. But I'd never give it a second time then. I think you would make a joke of the system if you do that, you know.
Okay.
You need the reputation of being tough but fair, is that?
Tough but fair, with loads of empathy, yeah, really. But the sisters, as you well know, they get to know your idiosyncrasies, you see,
sure,
which I don't mind at that at all. Though, you know. I don't know how many fellas appeared in front of me and they were going to play for Manchester United, you know, and they'd know that I'd be interested in that. Like, you know?
Yeah. don't send me down. You know, this could be ruining one of the greats.
Yeah.
You know, the next Roy Keane. And you have a relationship with Roy Keane, isn't that correct?
I have, yeah. Sorry. I have, yeah, for a number of years, really. Like, I act for a lot of soccer fellas in Cork, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then in 1990, I think approximately, Forrest played Spurs in the cup final, and Roy was a star at 19, and he came back with one of his buddies, and he was walking downtown, and a group came up in front of him, kind of, and cordoned him off, like, and started shouting at him, and he'd learned a small bit at that stage not to get involved, so he walked on, and he walked on, and he walked on, and came around to Pat Street, and the fourth time they stopped, he allegedly said to somebody, F off, or something like that, you something like that, you know. And within a day, imagine this in Cork City, within a day he got a civil bill for defamation. You know?
Wow. And, so they were aware of his prowess in Nottingham Forest.
They thought he'd pay, you
the
see,
big salary, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so, but it was on United, it was on Forest time, so I was put under desperate pressure then by United when he went to United, because they didn't want this case to go on at all, you know. And the jurisdiction at the time was 15,000. And they asked me what I would have settled for. And I said, I could settle for 5 grand and declaration of confidentiality, which wouldn't be worth the papers written on. Do that. He said, it's not in our time. We want it over. But I didn't want to do that at all. But I asked Roy, what did he think? And he said, and I thought it was lovely, but he said, you don't often hear this. He said, if I settle this case, my mother and father will never be able to go into a pub or restaurant in Cork again, he said.
So he wanted to fight.
Will the judge hear? And he said, and I ask you one question, will the judge hear my side? And I said, he will. He's a very good man. He's a reasonable man. And we fought the case and won it then, you know.
Okay, wow.
Which was a Mickey Mouse case against him, actually, you know.
What a fascinating, fascinating case and a fascinating client.
Yes.
We won't ask you where you came down in Saipan. I think I might be able to guess.
We won't
ask you about that at all. Okay, so look, just this has been really brilliant, Olin. It's a fascinating insight into the district court, and I'd say you are a wonderful judge to appear before. I never had the pleasure of appearing before you. But if you were to take one lesson away from your time in the district court, and if the Minister for Justice, Helen McAtee, rang you up and said, listen, Olin, you have great experience, what would you suggest we do? What should we do at district court level? Or what would you suggest? What did you learn?
I think we should try something on the drugs, you know. Now, in fairness to them, the Citizens Assembly have done something now, you know, and something more will come about that, and they've adopted part of the procedure we used in court. But the drugs are a huge problem now, huge problem. I saw terrible crimes as a result of drugs, you know. And they wouldn't do them when they're sober or under the influence of drugs, you know.
And so when people talk about sort of legalizing soft drugs and that kind of thing, do you think that's part of the solution?
Yeah, I'm not an academic, but I've read some of the stuff on it, you know. I mean, in Portugal, they're turning around again now, as you saw, you know. Mm. And it isn't clear-cut what we should be doing, but I do think we should be giving it a chance at the start and no more chances then, you know. I do think that'll work, you know.
Yeah.
But cocaine, you see, it's across the board now, I think, in society, cocaine. But at one stage, it was in the people could afford to buy it, you see, and they weren't criminals.
Yeah.
But they become criminals because they get hooked.
Yeah, of course.
Can I ask you a final question in relation to this? In terms of those appearing before you, I mean, we talk about the legal profession and how it's evolving. Yeah. And I think myself and Mark lament about the fact that a lot of it is based now on legal submissions. You go to the High Court and there's less kind of room for a bit of, you know, a bit of flair and a bit of theatricality, etc. Have you seen that in your years over Cork, or do you think there's still a little bit of...
There's some great performers in Cork.
And there still is.
I get killed by the time I get back to Cork, but we some of the best fellas around, you know. And they were very good and they were very clever at getting to me. Like, and I don't mind that at all. That's the game we're in, you know.
Yeah.
My brother Michael was a psychiatrist and he was a prominent psychiatrist in Cork, and he brought in this idea of in the hospital that anyone suffering from depression, etc., should be in the hospital rather than put it somewhere else, like, you know. And all the doctors were against him at the time, but he insisted on it. He was in charge of psychiatric services and he did that, and the nuns were delighted with him, but he died before it was opened, and his name was Michael Kelleher, and they named St. Michael's the ward. But of course, the solicitors found out immediately it was my brother, and they said he's getting fantastic treatment in St. Michael's ward. You know, so yes, I don't mind them doing that. I mean, I think that's their job.
Of course, absolutely, absolutely. Listen, this has been great, Olin. You know, we end with a question. I did mention this to you. I had to ring you up afterwards just to tell you, because of course I always forget. But a book, maybe on a legal theme that you'd like to recommend to our listeners. It could be non-legal as well.
No, well, one I loved actually, and I got my kids to read it and a lot of non-legal friends, is Rudon McCormack's book, The Supreme Court. I thought it was beautifully written. I thought it was a fantastic insight into Ireland and the judiciary. And they even had a bit about judges' political influence, which I never saw in writing before by anyone, you know. And I thought he did a magnificent job. And I gave it to one fellow, a friend of mine, who wasn't a lawyer, and he was asking about the political influence, and I said, well, look, you got to remember the great Maureen Potter quip, you know, where she said that Jack Lynch was the real Taoiseach. He was from Cork. We always called him the real Taoiseach in Cork. And he appointed a lot of his friends. He was a barrister himself. And he said, you must remember, she said from the stage, that the Four Courts is full of granite on the outside and full of cork on the inside.
Fantastic. And a movie. Did you think of a movie at all, or am I overdoing it with that question?
I think you cut me off for that.
Okay, yeah. All right, fair enough.
Sorry, I didn't think of that.
No, that's great. That's great. Olin Kelleher, retired district court judge. Just before, you've loads to do. Look at the energy and enthusiasm and everything you have. What are you going to do in the years to come?
There are a few balls in the air, but nothing's come down yet, you know.
Okay, can you give us an insight? We love breaking news on this show.
No, I've no idea, nothing yet. But I'd like to keep active anyhow, you know. I jump out of bed still in the morning, you know. But I don't know how more I can do it. I mean,
the clock ticked and you had to retire, isn't that it? You would have stayed if you could have stayed on.
I have no problem. I know the rules.
The rules are the rules. Retired District Court Judge Olin Kelleher, thank you for being a guest on the Fifth Court.
Thanks very much, Peter. Too.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to our guest, retired District Court Judge Olin Kelleher, who came in, and what a wonderful interview that was. Mark.
Yeah, very, very compassionate individual, I think. Yes. He must have been a great judge to appear in front of.
I mean,
of
that level of experience and empathy on the bench, I think that is, it's a pity he has retired. But obviously, as he says, he knows the rules, and the rules are the rules, and we have to
and
observe
maybe
the rules.
Greater things await.
Yes, hopefully. So that's all from this edition of the show, folks. Before we go, can I say a big thank you to our producer, Conal O'Moroyne, and to Dee Reddy, who has recorded this episode for us and has done a wonderful job. Thank you, Dee. So from me, Peter Leonard.
And myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisus Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.